Hello and welcome to the 2020 F1 Strategy Report, powered by Apex Race Manager, the mobile race management simulator. My name's Michael Aminato, and this is Round 13, the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix. Valtteri Bottas will have left the popular Imola track believing he should have taken home the winner's trophy. It was perhaps his best weekend of the year, but an errant piece of debris derailed his race and handed victory to Lewis Hamilton, while Mercedes won an unprecedented seventh straight constructors' title. For an analysis of F1's first two-day Grand Prix and another midfielder on the podium, I'm joined by Sky Sports F1's Ted Kravitz. Ted, how are you doing?
Laminato, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well. The sun is out. We're approaching the end of the championship fights. I mean, we all know where they were going. We can see the results from quite some distance away, but still a moment of celebration, I suppose.
The sun is out. Where? In Melbourne. Is it the end of spring?
Yes, lovely. Yes, it's going to be 30 degrees today. So straight after this, I'm going outside. It's going to be lovely.
Beautiful.
Now that I'm allowed out.
It's freezing. It's freezing in here. Not quite Nürburgring freezing, but yeah. Pretty cold in wintry London as we head towards the culmination of the latest running F1 season ever.
Yeah, well, I think we're definitely going to feel it as we look at Christmas from Abu Dhabi. Yeah. The weather, as you mentioned there, actually, is this weird curveball. It wasn't so much the case at Imola that was cooler than it would have been, of course, had we gone, let's say, at a more traditional time, somewhere in the middle of the year, but Turkey coming up as well. We're facing this unusual situation in F1, a summer series, where struggling to get temperature into the tyres, struggling to operate in the cooler climate is a bit of a twist for this series.
Yeah, but I think the drivers haven't got a problem with that, actually. I think they'd rather try to get temperature in their tyres, and certainly the engineers would, rather than have this, horrific tyre temperature overheating thing where they just have to drive slowly. At least you can drive aggressively and fast, and that has really rewarded the what I'm calling the greatest hits of worldwide Formula One Grand Prix tracks that's made up F1 2020. At least when we went to the Nürburgring, Portimao to a lesser degree, and I suppose Imola to a lesser degree because it's more an abrasive track on tyres. Anyway, the problem has been trying to get the heat into the tyres, not having to back off and drive to, within a lap time just to keep the rear tyres cool. So I think they'd rather it that way, and it's meant that the drivers can push flat out. We're getting more radio messages, aren't we, saying, can we have everything you've got now? And the drivers are like, I am everything I've got now, and I'd rather that, and rather, just them pootling around trying to match a target lap time.
Yeah, I suppose we saw that when Lewis got a cramp in Portugal to a lesser extent, really. It's not so common that you hear that happening in a car. The greatest hits, I think, is a really great way, actually, to describe a lot of the races we're having this season. A lot of tracks you don't ordinarily get in Formula 1, but proving extremely popular, certainly among the drivers. Imola's been one that I feel like every year someone is calling for it to come back on the calendar. Often the promoters at Imola themselves. This year, they got their wish. Yeah. Everyone seemed to really enjoy being there. Obviously, a wonderful historic setting. I thought it was really interesting. I saw this graphic, it was doing the rounds on social media this week, comparing the current 2021 car in size to the car that last took to Imola in 2006. Much bigger, obviously, the cars these days. We talk about this, fairly often, I suppose, but this was a really kind of great like-for-like example on this track. We talk a lot about tracks where overtaking is difficult, but how much of this should this thinking be reversed a bit in terms of trying to re-engineer the cars to be as small as possible, let's say, to improve that side of the sport?
Yeah, they're 4.5 meters long, aren't they? I think from memory, and a couple of meters wide. So, they are by design. I think it all comes back to the engine, really. When you've got the engine and the power unit that we've got now, and when you've got, an MG UK which weighs 35 kilos, and a battery that weighs probably a little bit more than that, then you're starting to have a really big, heavy car. And to put that through the air and onto a track, you need lots of downforce if it's not just going to go spinning off the track. And an easy way to make more downforce is just by to make more surface area of the car and more surfaces to generate downforce. And so the cars get longer and longer. The wheelbase is a little bit different from cars to cars. You get a lot of engineers. James Allison from Mercedes keeps telling me, don't believe the myth of the short wheelbase and the long wheelbase. There's only ever about 3 centimeters in it, and it doesn't make any difference. I don't think we are going to get any change in the size of the cars until 2022 at the earliest, and even then, I don't know, hopefully they'll be a little bit more nimble. But I don't know, I mean, I don't know whether Imola was a hard circuit to overtake because I can't remember much before the sort of early 80s. Certainly there was a bit more overtaking then, but if we remember to sort of my era when I was going there between 97 and 2006, it was pretty hard to overtake even then. So I don't think we should be surprised. Who can, you know, forget Michael Schumacher chasing down Fernando Alonso in 2005 and not being able to overtake a clearly faster Ferrari than Alonso's Renault at the time, due to whatever pit stops they were running. But Schumacher couldn't get past, and it was the most nail-biting finish to a Grand Prix. So, yeah, not a great track for overtaking, but hey, I'll take that because it is a challenge to the drivers. It's got character, and it's got soul and spirit. And, you know, I think it's a nice balance to have, isn't it? You know, people were complaining on the weekend. Some people were talking about the more, you know, antiseptic Tilke tracks, and yeah, you know that, but that's a fact of life. You design a circuit from scratch, you put it around, I don't know, the Olympic Park in Sochi. You know, there are some buildings that are going to define the track. All right, you've got a marina in Abu Dhabi you're basing it around, and sure, Bahrain was a clean sheet, but then you do have to put, you know, some serious kind of runoff areas to make sure it's super safe. And you probably wouldn't get away with designing an Imola the way it is now. But it's acceptable because it's there and it does meet just about the regulations, a bit like Japan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a balance, isn't it? I'm happy to have both on the calendar.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The challenge aspect certainly needs to be in there. And I think it does make a big difference when the drivers clearly enjoy themselves. I think that does make a massive difference to the spectacle, yeah, just on its own, quite aside from the racing. And we can talk a little bit about that challenge a little bit later on with Valtteri Bottas. But just before that, I want to just touch on the fact that this was the first, well, let's say the first intentional two-day weekend. I feel like we've actually accidentally had a couple in the last month of no practice on Friday, effectively. This is a bit of a test model, if you like, for Formula One, isn't it? Because we're looking at calendars with more races on it. This is a way to reduce that workload. But I think more to the point, and perhaps a little bit more relevant in this context, is that Formula One seems like it already has so much practice. And surely this was evidence that we just don't need 4 hours on a weekend for teams to really perfect their cars before starting qualifying.
No, we don't. But, you know, we're there anyway, and everybody was there from Wednesday, and we all flew out. I mean, I flew out Wednesday night because I had some filming to do on Thursday. All the drivers were there Wednesday because they wanted to get there nice and early, and all the cars were ready to go. Sure, there were some elements of the paddock that were still being built up, having driven the, you know, 48 hours from the very southern tip of Portugal, across Portugal, across Spain, across France, you know, across a bit of Italy, and then down to Imola. But, you know, it was only the last things to be built were the paddock buildings. All the garages were sorted out. There was a story about the crane needed to build the Racing Point motorhome. The Racing Point coordinator and said, "Ciao, I'm here at the gate." And he said, "Oh, okay, I'll come to see you." This was relayed to me by another team. And so the Racing Point guy goes to the Imola gate. Says, "Right, where are you then?" Says, "Well, I'm here, just by this big red helmet, and it says Circuito de Mugello on it." Says, "Oh, you've gone to Mugello." Yes. Why is there nobody here? Luckily, it was only about 100 miles. It's only about 100 miles from Mugello. It's actually less. I think it's less from Mugello to Imola. So the crane did arrive, and the Racing Point motorhome could go up. I don't know. I'm not, you know, paid to give an opinion, but if you want one, I don't like it. I think there's no point. I think anyone... Do you know, I think the people who said, "Oh, marvellous, you know, 2-day weekend," I just think their hearts aren't in it. You know, if you're not prepared to do the work and be there for 3 days, then go and find another job. You know, it's not about being easy for you. Just come in on a, you know, very convenient for your work-life balance. Thank you very much. Come on. Grand Prix are events, right? They are events. It's a World Cup final. Well, it's not a World Cup final. It's a football final. It's a minor football final every weekend. Okay, it's not an AFL grand final weekend, I understand that, you know, but it's a major world sporting event every weekend. And if you're not prepared to make an event of it, then you're in the wrong job, you know. So it's showbiz, it's entertainment. And part of that for me is the anticipation. Mm-hmm. You go for a week, and I say this on the TV on the weekend, you go for a week thinking, oh, you know, where are we next? Oh, Imola, great. And the anticipation, and Friday is building anticipation. It's raising questions about, oh, did you see that lap? That was good. Oh, you know, Norris was P3. Wow. Okay. You know, do you think he can make that? Oh, what was, you know, Vettel doing down there? Or, oh, did you see the crash for him? Or, you know, what's going on? And it transfers through, and everyone's, you know, can do some testing as well. And we couldn't do any testing in Imola. Saturday morning was flat out, well, we've got to do this on the soft tire, got to do this on the medium tire, and we've got to do this on the hard tire. Then we've got to do some heavy fuel. Then we've got to do some light fuel. Oh, we've got a problem. You know, that's lost us 20 minutes. Oh, you want, oh, setup changes, did you? No, did you want a setup change? Sorry, mate, can't do a setup change. We haven't got the time. So I'm not on for it. I'm really not up for it. I think it's ill-conceived. I don't think it saves anybody any time. And I think it makes things harder. And I think we have more people dropping out. And all right, you could discuss whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. In Nürburgring, we had a lot of retirements. And I think in Imola, we had quite a few retirements as well. You know, would Renault have spotted that there was a drive shaft, you know, problem on Ocon's car on a Friday, having done an hour and a half round a sort of super aggressive, you know, and punishing circuit like Imola? Would they have spotted that? Maybe. And then he wouldn't have, you know, retired with that problem. And yeah, so for so many of those reasons, I think a 2-day weekend is the wrong way to go for F1. Ah, there you go, got it off my chest.
Well, yeah, look, it's important to, you got to get that stuff off your chest, don't let it build up. But it's, look, some good points made there. I think in particular that there's the time saving aspect. I can't see that actually being that much of a time saver, but we'll wait and see how Formula One moves in this direction. One thing I thought that it did do, though, and you sort of touched on it there, I suppose in a sense in the inverse way, but it meant that risk was greater because you couldn't take so much risk in practice, could you? It's easier to take risk on Friday practice, knowing if you've been in the car, you've got a whole day pretty much to fix it before qualifying. Couldn't happen in practice. And I feel like as a result in qualifying, this really rewarded drivers willing to risk it. And I suppose we can start talking about Valtteri Bottas here. He said he was left shaking by his lap. One of the rare times he does manage to beat Lewis Hamilton in qualifying, though he has been close for most of the year. And I feel like that willingness sort of put him one step ahead for pretty much the entire weekend, notwithstanding that he picked up damage on Sunday. But the willingness to risk, I think, was really rewarded this weekend.
Yes, but I think that would have been the same whether it was a 2-day weekend or a 3-day weekend, because it was just the nature of the Imola track. You know, they were all buzzing after qualifying because you have to take those risks on a big qualifying lap. It is a big daddy, big challenge track. And, you know, it's not like, you know, strangely, compared to Monza, the speeds are much higher at Monza, but because there's not actually that much, you know, that they do in Monza, they effectively just, you know, go through chicanes and then there's just one couple of fast corners. They sort of get out of the car and say, well, that was all the car that, you know, that was all that the car could have done. That's it. But you get out of Imola, you've wrestled the car around, you've taken risks, you've, you know, danced the car on the edge of adhesion, you've gone over the curbs, not knowing whether it's all going to stick, and you've pushed it over the line, and it's given you that reward. And they were all buzzing. Daniel Ricciardo, you know, you don't even have to be on pole. Daniel Ricciardo was fifth on the grid. And he said it was one of the best qualifying experiences he'd ever had. You know, he was absolutely just fizzing when he came in for an interview afterwards. Valtteri Bottas had a kind of adrenaline high that he was riding straight after, the shivering, you know, included, was sort of, and then came down in the interview pen afterwards, and you could see he was getting cold. Right. One of his team members had to bring him a big jacket. because he was starting to sort of get a bit chilled and he was on a big adrenaline down. And then he came to the touchscreen that we have and did a bit with Karun Chandhok, and he was pretty much monosyllabic. He was cold, he was on adrenaline down, and he was sort of drained and wanted to go and lie down in his room because that was the adverse of that. And yes, you know, they were taking risks. I think Hamilton made a couple of mistakes. I think had he actually executed as fantastic a lap as Valtteri Bottas, then I think he would have been, you know, buzzing as well. But he was a little bit disappointed. Sure, full of the adrenaline that you get doing after qualifying around Imola, but he was disappointed that he was not on pole position. But that was a change later. But yeah, I think that's more of a, you know, thing about the... I think that would have happened anyway, rather than the having the risk of just being having to throw everything at it because you haven't had that much practice and don't know where the sort of limit is.
Absolutely part of this circuit, I think that's fair to say. A Mercedes on pole, a good getaway for Valtteri Bottas as well. I feel like this was one of his better weekends of the season, maybe his best since Austria, just off the top of my head, that first round of the season where he seemed like he had everything in hand. Everything seemed like going well. He should have been able to win from that position, having led away on that first lap. We know that that wasn't the case, though. I was shocked at how big a piece of debris he picked up on lap two, because this was really the defining moment of the race. This is the thing that the whole race pivoted on, was ironically a piece of Ferrari, probably the fastest piece of Ferrari all season, was the piece lodged in Valtteri Bottas's barge boards. Nearly 8/10 of a second a lap he was losing, but you wouldn't have guessed in that first stint, other than perhaps the fact that Max Verstappen seemed unusually fast relative to a Mercedes car.
Yes, it was when Verstappen was closing on him quite considerably, and the W11, which was clearly the class of the field in Imola. Imola seemed made for the W11, the Mercedes W11. It seemed, you know, able to stretch its legs, and that, what was that? It was half a second. It was 4/10 of a second, I think, that the Mercedes had on the Red Bull in qualifying. Mm-hmm. And in the race, it looked much closer. And we thought, you know, before we knew about this bit of Ferrari front wing end plate, oh, well, that's just, you know, the in race pace, you know, the Red Bull is better. But actually, the Red Bull was kind of miles off in the race as well. It was only sort of Max Verstappen managing, you know, his brilliance, managing to get up close. And they said it was 50 points of downforce, 5-0. And on a, you know, on a package that takes them, you know, months to think up and then build, you know, you're happy if you get 3 or 4 or 5 points of downforce on there. It's fantastic. You know, that's a great upgrade. And to have that bit lodged in the crucial part of the front part of the floor around the bib is very bad. They could see it from lap two, but, and this is the interesting thing, when Bottas came in for his first pit stop chasing Verstappen, they felt that it would have lost them more time and track position at a track where track position is king to actually pull out the bit of Ferrari front wing end plate. So they left it in there. They knew it was there. They saw it in the pit stop and they left it in there because they thought that was the lesser of two evils. Had Verstappen got in front, you know, through a 4-second pit stop, 5-second to try and wrench this bit out, you know, they thought that would probably be it, because he had track position. Even if Bottas was suddenly much quicker because he was debris free, that would be it. So it was a mighty drive by Bottas, and who knows what would have happened. They did eventually get it out in the second pit stop, didn't they, under the safety car.
It was that first pit stop was really interesting because there were two obviously distinct minds here. Mercedes had an idea of what was going on, obviously knowing that the Bottas car was affected by this. And Red Bull Racing, for a brief period of time, thought that this race was really on. Couldn't get passed on track. That was a sort of defining part in terms of strategy in this Grand Prix, of course. The passing was quite difficult. So decided to stop really quite early for a team, or the top three to start on the medium tyre, but to stop so early on lap 18 just to try something. In ordinary circumstances, that would have been their race over, really, because Bottas would have had no trouble overcutting Verstappen at this point in the same way that Hamilton did later. But really had no choice, did they, but to cover that one and then lock themselves into this, what should have been really a really long duel towards the end, trying to defend aggressively against Verstappen. What wasn't going to happen in the end, I suppose, because Verstappen did get past him. But really accidental work there for Red Bull Racing, I suppose.
Yeah, and it was worth, I guess it was worth a go for Red Bull. Let's not forget that they don't have the second car in play to try and, you know, trick Hamilton or Bottas into a stop. You know, it was okay qualifying for Alex Albon, but not great. And then Albon had to stop early on lap 14 anyway. I think he was reacting around to Lando Norris, but yeah, Albon had his own issues. But it was worth a go because, you know, Verstappen's only in it to try and win races. They went onto the hard tire. They knew that it was going to be hard to get to the end on that hard tire and be fresh. And that's how Mercedes knew that they had it covered with either car. And that was the point, wasn't it? If they let, not only did Bottas manage to cover Verstappen and get out still in front of him because he'd done enough in that first stint to build a little bit of a gap, despite body, you know, front wing, end plate debris, and all. But that's the advantage that Mercedes have when they've got, you know, Bottas and Hamilton in there, both at the front, that they can cover it with Bottas and then try something different from Hamilton. And they don't care who wins. Obviously, if Bottas, you know, is on pole, they kind of think, well, you know, he's done half the job. We should give him the best chance to win that we can. But it looked like Hamilton was going to win anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, especially knowing that first stop aside, the Verstappen aspect aside, that car was damaged, pretty logical for Mercedes thereby to focus on making sure that Lewis Hamilton at least was in the best position to win here. Ran long, ran to lap 30, had a bit of luck here though, didn't he? He was bringing out that gap, depending on which numbers you wanted to look at, and we can sort of analyze the pit stop numbers at the end of the race. He needed somewhere between 26 and 30 seconds to be a pit stop ahead of Bottas. Just about got it, but then Esteban Ocon, I suppose, helped him out. The virtual safety car helped him out. And it does feel like Bottas can't get any luck here. I mean, notwithstanding how damaged, and maybe he wouldn't have been able to win anyway because of that, but, you know, he was doing just enough to keep in that window of Lewis Hamilton. And then, of course, a virtual safety car undoes all that work anyway.
Story of Bottas' season. You know, he didn't have the luck. Did not have the luck. He's had it in so many ways. But, you know, if you believe in luck, then maybe luck will come his way next season. We will see. And Hamilton has had the luck. You know, it summed up his season. Just when he needs to, he gets something that really, really helps him out. But as he was, you know, keen to remind everybody afterwards, you know, he had done enough. He saw Bottas and Verstappen pit, what, 18 and lap 18 and 19, thought they were crazy. Thought, well, hang on, we didn't do all the hard work in Q2 to qualify on this medium tire, only for you to now go and pit when a soft tire would have pitted. You know, it would have been easy. If we were going to pit on 18 and 19, I wouldn't have bothered trying to get the heat into the medium tires in Q2. Would have just gone onto the easy route, onto the soft. So he initially, you know, knew that he was going to go, wanted to go longer. Lap 26 was kind of the bare minimum that he thought he was going to pit by, and actually he went to 30. I think he could have gone even longer, just he still felt there was good life in the tyres. But then there was that virtual safety car, and I think it was within about 5 or 6 seconds, virtual safety car was called, 3, 2, 1, and I saw Lewis round the second Rivazza and then head into the pits. And it was just perfect. It was just perfect. Everyone else was slowing down. I saw it from the pit building roof. Everyone was like, oh, and they all started slowing down. I thought, oh, that's odd. And I looked at the boards and it said VSC. I thought, okay, right. And then about 5 seconds later, Hamilton comes in. And then about 5 seconds after that, it said virtual VSC ending. And everyone got up to speed again. So what would have cost him, as you said, about 27 seconds. Let's call it, it's about an average of the of the estimates between sort of 26 and 28 seconds. Only cost him 17. So he had a very, very healthy lead when he came back out. And that was the luck of the draw. And the unlucky Bottas, who later on, of course, got passed by Verstappen on track, didn't he? What was it? Was it a lockup or something? It was, wasn't it?
Yeah, and went a bit wide at the last two corners,
went
right?
A bit wide.
Was it Rivazza? I think it was.
That's right. Yeah. And then Verstappen got past him before before Verstappen's problem.
Yeah, and of course that was the second defining moment of this race, was Verstappen's tyre failure. In the end, I mean, everyone's quite worked up about this kind of tyre failure. It seemed like it was debris. That's Pirelli's initial analysis, isn't it? But since Silverstone, there's been a lot of concern whenever this sort of thing happens. Teams and drivers were reporting vibrations on these tyres. And the safety car, not for Verstappen, obviously, he caused it. His tyre failed, but allowed the two leading Mercedes drivers to make that safety stop onto the softs, get comfortably to the end of the race, then Hamilton leading Bottas in that order. But the difference of starting on the soft or medium tyre was really defining in that final podium position, with Verstappen out of the picture. Alex Albon still mired in the midfield, as you touched on, and in fact fell well out of the points after the safety car restart. This should have been Sergio Perez's first podium in 2 years, really. First podium of the season. He'd done such good work up until this point. He'd started 11th, the first to have free tyre choice, started on the medium, and then did really what Perez does so well, what we know he does so well, which is just perfectly manage pace over a long stint all the way to lap 27, which is probably about where the medium tyre should have got anyway. But this was really, it should have been a Perez race, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, on the Verstappen tyre failure, I'm willing to give Pirelli the benefit of the doubt, because Leclerc and Ricciardo got to the end from an earlier stop than Verstappen on that hard tyre. So Ricciardo and Leclerc pitted. Leclerc lap 13, Ricciardo lap 14, and they ran all the way to lap 63 on that hard tyre with no kind of looking like a structural failure or anything like that. Giovinazzi stopped on lap 10 and went to the end 63 on a set of mediums. So, you know, I don't think the tyres had a sort of innate structural problem. It did look like, I don't know what bit of debris it was that caused the puncture, or a stone or whatever, you know, but little bits of carbon fiber fly off these cars all the time. So it is possible that the Verstappen probable, I think we should also say, that his tire failure was caused by some sort of debris rather than some sort of structural failure of the tire. But to go back to your point about Checo Perez, yeah, and I don't know, it's a weird one, because shouldn't we pit under the safety car? Seems to be a slightly recurring theme on the Racing Point pit wall. This is the third time this year that there's been a critical should we, shouldn't we call. And I think they're starting to sort of lose a little bit of confidence up there, because the first one, maybe you can remind me where this was. The first one was wrong and they should have pitted. The second one, they were right to keep him out. And now they pitted. Where were the two earlier on in the season? Anyway, there'll be listeners who know exactly what we're talking about, screaming into their whatever they're listening to us on. But you know, it has been a little bit of a should we, shouldn't we? Two reasons why they did pit him, and why they didn't do, you know, the obvious thing, which would have been to leave him out. You know, having pitted on lap 27, Checo was saying, well, come on, hang on, you know, we've got this quite young tyre here, and I'm sure we can go to the end. But two reasons. First of all, they had set up the car to be slow to heat up its tyres to manage to get this long stint length out of the medium tyre early on to lap 27, which they did very successfully. And they thought, well, hang on, you know, we've got this car that's really, you know, the old slow heater today. And if we leave Checo out there on the cars, on the white tyres, on the white hard tyres, the car is going to be very slow to heat them up. So we don't really want to do that. And they also thought that on the soft tyre, you'd get good heat and the cars in front would suffer more than they did, and they'd be able to pick them off. He didn't manage to get past Leclerc, and it was sixth in the end when it should have been third. But, you know, these things happen. It was a mistake. I just think they needed to get, you know, track position is king. Yeah. I think if we ever go back to Imola on the pit wall, or on the file saying, you know, what to do in the race in Imola and Racing Point, they'll put a post-it note saying track position is king. so So just bear that in mind.
It is. I mean, you feel like, and I thought it at the time as well, that really track having earned that track position with passing so difficult, that really should have been the, I don't necessarily want to say obvious, because as you said, there were reasons in their mind. They didn't do it for no reason. They had their motivations to stop him, but should have been clear that with a racing point car that is usually, in most circumstances, fast enough to run a defence, hold that track position, unfortunately gave it up there. In fact, I think he was quite upset on the radio afterwards, wasn't he, from what I've heard, is that, you know, he immediately saw that that was a call that shouldn't have been made. And I think Charles Leclerc was asked by his pit wall as well, and his response was, I don't think I can pass any cars if we stop, and probably worked out for him as well. But I suppose if you wanted to be kinder to the Racing Point pit wall, you'd point to Daniel Kvyat, wouldn't you? Because he did also stop behind the safety car. Had less to lose, I suppose, so it was not such a gamble. But he pretty much did what Perez was expected to do, or what the team had hoped he would do, passed three or four cars at the restart and spent the last five laps of this essential five-lap sprint race
going crazy,
challenging Ricciardo. Yeah, going absolutely crazy. Not enough to save his drive, no, to help it market, but a very, very much exactly what you'd expect for someone on new soft tyres, I suppose.
Well, according to Pirelli, it was actually Fiat's tyre was a used soft.
Yeah,
had done three laps from qualifying, whereas actually Perez's tyre was new. So yes, you know, that just underlines Fiat's achievement to get back up to fourth with that pit stop, and whether Checo wasn't able to do it. I mean, listen, you know, maybe you could come up with some sort of COD driver psychology, you know, idea that Fiat just went completely, you know, crazy and let's go for it. Ooh, you know, let's overtake people. Whereas Checo isn't really that kind of driver. You know, he's sort of king tire preservation. And that's what was his strength and what was leading him to the podium, and to drop him in and ask him to go to risk everything and to go for some crazy overtakes wasn't really playing to his sort of, you know, personal strengths as a driver. You know, I don't like to categorize drivers like that, but, you know, Kvyat clearly didn't have anything to lose, said that he was willing to make the risks, did it, particularly on Leclerc. I think Leclerc was surprised to see him, maybe. But I think Leclerc, you know, was sort of just outperforming that Ferrari all weekend long, all season long, you could say, and probably would have said, okay, well, the AlphaTauri is clearly quicker than us. But, you know, I'm going to have to give up the place here. But Rick, as Danny Rick said, you know, the Racing Point was actually the third quickest car. The fourth quickest car. No, the third quickest car, that's right. Mercedes, Red Bull, and then Racing Point, and deserved to be on the podium. The Renault wasn't the third quickest car, but Ricciardo managed to make it work with some smart driving and good strategy.
The fact that we got into this situation to begin with Perez leapfrogging most of the midfield having started 11th, was because a lot of those drivers who had to start on softs, having qualified in Q2 with them, got caught in this undercut train we sometimes see happen in races where passing is a bit difficult, no one wants to take too much risk. They all stop between lap 13 and 14. This is Ricciardo, Kvyat, Leclerc, Albon, pretty much both McLaren. Yep. Sainz went a little bit longer. We'll talk about him in a second.
The midfield pitters, yes.
Yeah, all got stuck behind Kevin Magnussen, who was running long on the medium tyre, having dropped to the back, getting tangled up with Sebastian Vettel early on in the race. That led to Bottas picking up that debris, coincidentally enough. I understand the rationale, the psychology behind that, because no one wants to take a risk when recovering positions by passing is difficult and there's only one stop in this race. But that was still quite early for these soft tyres, for everyone to stop on these tyres, to risk, and being able to see that Magnussen was there as well. You could see it in the times. They emerged pretty much directly behind him and were stuck behind him for 13 or 14 laps. Are you surprised so few drivers and teams take the risk of staying out in that situation? Are you surprised that they all take that bait?
I think they're so terrified of being undercut. None of them, or very few of them, have the confidence to overcut other people. Because they're sort of hardwired in to think, oh, I don't want to be undercut here. Case in point, Kimi Raikkonen and Sebastian Vettel. So this was quite a nice fight, sort of lower down in the midfield. Neither of them were tempted into the midfield. Let's go for it. Which, by the way, was started by Romain Grosjean. Mm-hmm. So blame him. who, the moment Grosjean had to stop at lap 9, then ahead of him, Russell thought, like Russell and Giovinazzi thought, oh, better not be undercut here. So then stopped lap 10, 11, Ocon 13, Norris 13, Leclerc 13, Kvyat 14. And it moved like a, one might say like a virus, up through from the lower part of the midfield into the top part of the midfield. And so, like so many people who've come across the Frenchman, you can blame Grosjean for that one. But as I say, yeah, Kimi and Seb weren't tempted into that. Kimi went long to 48. Seb was the first. And this was an interesting fight because Seb pitted lap 39. Kimi and was just about to undercut Kimi Raikkonen. But on the Alfa Romeo Sauber pit wall, they could see that the Ferrari was coming back and a decent chance, as Kimi's tyres were starting to fade, of being undercut by Sebastian Vettel. So just before Vettel was about to undercut Raikkonen, they decided to pit him. That was lap 48. And they remained ahead of him. So it was the right decision. There they are, thinking they've done a great job there. Thank heaven for that. We've stayed ahead of the Ferrari. We're going to be racing him to the finish here. Two laps later, what happens? Safety car. And they had to do what they were going to do. But if they had have waited, not that they were ever going to, but if they'd have waited to lap 51 in the safety car, then Kimi would have been something like seventh, and having to defend at his position towards the end. But you would have had to be completely bonkers to do that because you would have given up an undercut to Sebastian Vettel based on nothing. Based on what? Based on, Ocon might have a drive shaft failure. Verstappen might have a tyre failure here. And we can take advantage of a safety car. So, they did the right thing at the right time, did Alfa Romeo Sauber. They weren't to know there was going to be a safety car, but they did indeed end up still ahead of Sebastian Vettel and a few cars in between, and both Alfa Sauber scored points, which doesn't happen every race, so that was a decent return for them.
First time this year, I think, that both have scored points, and you're absolutely right, they had no choice but to stop at that point. No one can forecast that safety car, but I think he was as high as fourth just before his tyres started to fade a little bit, and then he ultimately pitted. So it shows that he would have been much higher up in the order had fortune been that the safety car had come out a little bit earlier, and then who knows how high he could have been able to finish there, probably mid points. But this is something that's quite typical of Alfa Romeo, isn't it? Or Sauber, as it used to be, that they would run these sort of left-of-field strategies.
Still is Sauber.
Yeah, well, technically, sorry. I mean, I should get their business number as well so that we can reference that just to be absolutely certain.
Sorry. Go on.
Look, you're right. We should be technically correct on this program. That's sort of the point. But Giovinazzi also ran pretty much the same but opposite, the inverse version of Raikkonen's strategy, only 10 laps on the soft and then all the way to the end on a single set of tyres on the medium. Crucially, not being tempted to stop behind the safety car as well, which earned him a couple of places towards the end. But, comparing that, as we sort of did with a lot of the midfield teams, I guess where it's much tighter there, where everyone is already de facto competing for points, it's easy to get caught up in a trend. But for Alpha, where they're always trying to break into the points, I guess it's a little bit easier to be ambitious. But this is normally a strength of theirs, and it was good to see them rewarded for just a completely different strategy, really.
Yes, it was. And I think that's slightly encouraged by what happened in the opening lap of Portimao.
Yeah.
Where Kimi went, absolutely, Mr. Overtaking Trousers and entertained everybody by getting up to fourth, I think, wasn't it? Or maybe sixth.
Yeah.
From more or less a sort of mid-teens grid position. But it was all very entertaining, got everybody excited on social media. Have a look at Kimi's amazing first lap. It was Portugal, wasn't it?
It was very good as well.
It was Portugal. As the rain started to go and everybody was on the medium tyres and Kimi was on the soft tyres and, Carlos Sainz took the lead and Raikkonen was right up there. I kind of think Sauber thought, or Alfa Romeo thought, Ruth Boscombe thought, let's have a bit of that again. Let's see if Giovinazzi can do that this time. Whereas they were pretty much the only ones out of the people who had free tyre choice to start on the soft. But you're right. It did work out quite well for them. I think he was, where was he? 20th?
Yeah, he
started
last.
He was, wasn't he?
Six places on the first lap, I think, as well.
He started last because he made a mistake. That's right. That's right. And got up to P14, didn't he, on the first lap. So it worked well for them on a track you can't overtake. It was a nice idea and it worked. So well done. Well done, Ruth Buscombe.
Yeah, just two more points I want to touch on before we wrap this one up. One directly related to where Giovinazzi was able to finish, and perhaps even where Raikkonen was able to finish in those last 2 points paying places. Partly fortune or misfortune, depending on whose aspect you're taking here, whose angle, on Vettel's part. Because Vettel, as you said, had been in that race. He'd been fighting for a point. It was one of his, painful to say for a four-time world champion, but better races to be fighting for a couple of points, at least of recent times. But a Ferrari error here, a pit stop error, quite a poor pit stop late in the race on two corners of the car. I think it cost him 10 or 11 seconds stationary time that dropped him out of the competition for points. Nothing much he could do from there. But, you know, it feels like it's rare that you can draw a thread through one team making several strategy and pit stop mistakes, and it's inevitably Ferrari. In a year where their car is obviously not that great, improving a little bit admittedly, at least in Leclerc's hands, but generally not very good, struggling at an awful lot of tracks, surely the one thing that shouldn't have surely one thing that should remain polished, let's say, for a team so well-resourced is the pit stop side of things, is the pit wall side of things, I suppose, where it's all just practice makes perfect, really.
Well, you would have thought, wouldn't you? But I wonder whether a kind of, you know, drudgery of trying to get through a season that they know is below par, and whether there's a lack of sharpness through the white hot element, you know, heat of competition and of championship challenging. I think when you get that sort of energy within a team, you know you're challenging for wins. And you know you're challenging for a championship, everything tightens up, everybody tightens up, and you make sure in that pit stop practice that you get everything done and there are no mistakes. And surely, you know, sure, Ferrari have had mistakes even when they've been challenging for wins and challenging for the championships. But I think mentally, if not operationally, there is a little bit of it's not really going to matter, is it? You know, we're not going to be able to, you know, fourth is probably the best we can get, a podium maybe. You know, we're not exactly, we don't really have to push ourselves here because, you know, the car's not good enough to challenge for the win. I don't think, you know, clearly they don't want to mess up. And I think the Ferrari pit crew would have been as gutted as, you know, as Seb was, that they had that problem on the left rear and the right front. But I wonder whether there's a little bit of ambition, you know, the ambition goes with the reality of where they're racing at the moment and the sharpness goes. But, you know, they're getting it fine on Leclerc's car, but they're still not delivering the sort of sub 2 second pit stops that Red Bull are and that Williams can on their day and that Mercedes can on their day. So maybe they need to invest a bit of time and money into getting them sharp to be there when the car eventually improves, as inevitably it will. It's just going to take a bit of time.
Look, as a final point, McLaren had a solid but unspectacular race in Imola, scored some points, keeping them very much in that third place battle. It's only 1 point separating third to fifth in the Constructors' Championship. But, you know, overtaking was part of their problem here. They didn't qualify that great and then felt they couldn't make any progress in the race. But also didn't really try anything, considering they had two cars in the mix here. Didn't really try anything novel. Sainz stayed out a little bit longer than all the midfielders, but only four laps and didn't gain anything from it at the first stop. Initially, they left Lando Norris out behind the safety car, but I believe he asked to come in and they stopped him a couple of laps later, didn't lose any places, and then had Sainz and Norris on the same strategy, essentially, at the end, couldn't gain any places again.
Yeah.
Is it that this fight is very close? There's a lack of willingness to try something in the event you might lose the 4 points that Norris scored, for example? Would you have expected them to be a little bit ambitious here just to see what could be gained in a race that really wasn't offering much on-track action, let's say?
Maybe, but I think they were predilected by two things that made them risk-averse. Firstly was that they wanted and were absolutely determined to score points with both cars in Imola, which they hadn't done in some previous races. Certainly Russia and Nürburgring, they hadn't scored points with both cars. because that's going to help them. That's the only thing that's going to get them or keep them close to P3 in the constructors, is if, unlike Racing Point and Renault, who seem every race to have only one car scoring points, whichever one that is, even though I think in Portimao, Ocon and Ricciardo did both score points. But today only Ricciardo did. So first of all, they wanted to make sure they both scored points. Secondly, they were predilected to making the one stop work. And I think with Lando Norris, were bounced into the early stop by that midfield early rash of stoppers that we talked about earlier than they would have wanted to. And you know, I think they wanted to get to lap 25, 26 on that soft tire, which they were showing, you know, like decent pace that they were, because they were driving to protect that red soft tire early on in the first stint, and they stopped earlier than they wanted to. And by that time, everything was a little bit compromised. It made sense for them to stop afterwards under the safety car, but by then, you know, it was a used soft tire, and they couldn't really close on Perez, even though it was pretty close. I think what they're concerned about now is that AlphaTauri is now a faster car with Kvyat. And while I don't think they think AlphaTauri will be challenging them for a constructor's place, because AlphaTauri are pretty far down in terms of points, they don't want AlphaTauri getting in their fight with Renault and Racing Point. And if they can just be solid and score, you know, 10, 12 points, whatever, 15 points across the two cars, that's going to give McLaren the best chance of trying to get third, but at least securing fourth. If they drop to fifth, which would be one place below where they are at the moment, McLaren and the constructors, that would be really, really disappointing. They really don't want to do that. If, you know, minimum, they want to stay fourth in constructors, maximum move up to third. And I think that probably pushes some of their decisions.
Well, the Constructors' Championship was decided this weekend, but that battle for third is going to go right down to the last race, and it certainly is an interesting one. I can't wait to see how it's going to balance out. But to look back on Imola, classic track, everyone was very excited about it.
Yeah, well, it was a classic track, except for George Russell, of course, who we should extend our condolences to. And, you know, I was reflecting myself today, you know, who amongst us can honestly say we've never made a massive mistake that we've been really, really annoyed with ourselves about. George Russell did. He was set for a point. He would have got the point, I think, that Giovinazzi ended up with, because he was staying out under the safety car on the hard tire, and he would have got a point, maybe even one more, maybe even 2 points for ninth. But yeah, that mistake. Things never to do, we've learned from Imola, is, you know, risk the car of doing something as silly as and insignificant and probably ultimately pointless as trying to, you know, warm your hard tires up under the safety car. And other things not to do is decide that, like Haas, you're not going to change your gearbox after qualifying, because it would drop you some places on the opening lap, even if it is giving your driver Kevin Magnussen a kick in the back of the head because of some harsh upshifts, then have an incident early in the race, drop to last where you would have been anyway had you changed the gearbox, and then having to retire because the driver is effectively getting a migraine because of this upshift, giving the driver a kick in the back of the head. So yeah, two more things not to do in Imola if and when we hopefully go there sometime in the future.
An educational weekend for everyone, in other words. We all learned something.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Ted.
Thanks. Cheers.
That was Ted Kravitz from Sky Sports F1. The Strategy Report is powered by Apex Race Manager, the mobile race management simulator. Play it for free on iOS and Android devices. If you want more Strategy Report, you can get every episode by subscribing on Google and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on your favorite podcast app, plus all of your social media channels. And if you like what you've heard, we'd love it if you could give us a rating and a review to help other F1 fans find the show. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you next week for a preview of the Turkish Grand Prix.